To CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live on the unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. My name is Ruby Raven, and I am your host of Shmodio. We are back. We are back, and we are better than ever. I just got back from TIFF TIFF. Toronto International Film Festival. Me and my amazing producer, Callum, we went to TIFF on behalf of CITR, and we saw films, and we interviewed filmmakers, and we went to really cool events, and it was as cool as it sounds. I mean, it was really, really cool. I really want to give a big shout out to the Media Inclusion Initiative. That is the program with which we were allowed to attend. It's an initiative that TIFF puts on in order to get a more diverse range of critics who may not have access to the resources that would allow them to get to TIFF through more established routes. So thank you so much for creating this program, TIFF, because it was a really, really incredible experience to be able to go and talk to these filmmakers. So I am going to be pumping out a lot of TIFF content in the next few weeks. Callum's going to be on the show. We're going to debrief TIFF. He's going to talk about some of the films he saw and some of the people that he interviewed. And I'm so excited to sort of ruminate on everything that we did because it was a really, really, really crazy 10 days. But today, to kick off our TIFF content, we have interviews done by me, Ruby Raven, with Ron Lachem and Hagar Ben Asher. That's right, I went to Hebrew school and I can pronounce their Israeli names. They are the writer, director, producer. Well, Ron Lachem is the writer and executive producer, and Hagar is a writer and director of the series Bad Boy. It's a new Israeli series about a troubled teen who's sent away to a brutal juvenile detention facility. And this dynamic drama from the creator of the Israeli series upon which HBO's Euphoria is based. So that's right. I did not know that either, that Euphoria, the American HBO version of Euphoria, was based on Ron Lachem's original Euphoria in Israel. So he brought it to the States, he shopped it around, HBO bought it, and Sam Levinson executive produced and created it, but Ron Lachem was also an executive producer on the American version. So you'll hear us talk a little bit about Euphoria in the interview, but mostly we're just focusing on his new show, Bad Boy, which I'll explain in the interview. You'll hear me explain the concept of the show in a little bit more depth, but these interviews were so interesting. I'm really excited to kick off our TIFF series with these two interviews because I left them on a high because of how interesting Hagar and Ron were to talk to. They were so deep and insightful and vulnerable, and they gave me so much to think about. And I think that after hearing these interviews, everyone is going to want to watch this show. And then we'll have a little bit of time at the end of the episode to talk about one of the films that I saw at TIFF. I'm going to be talking about a film called In the Rear View, which is a documentary about driving out displaced Ukrainians from Ukraine to Poland. There was this documentarian, and he rented a van, and he would drive back and forth between Poland and Ukraine to get these displaced peoples out. It was so beautiful, so moving. So I'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the episode. But without further ado, let's hear Hagar's interview first. This is Hagar Ben Asher's interview with me, Ruby Raven, at TIFF about her new show, Bad Boy. Here we go.
Welcome, Hagar Ben Asher. You are on CITR Radio. My name's Ruby Raven. And thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me today about your new TV series, Bad Boy.
Thank you for having me here.
So my first question about your work on it, you directed all 8 episodes, and it's a story about a boy who goes to a juvenile detention center and forms a friendship with one of the most violent, psychotic boys in the detention center, and how they sort of navigate that their experience there. And then later on, that character becomes a comedian, a very famous comedian. You're filming this, you're directing this show, and you're exploring the vulnerability of the lead character, Dean, as he's in this prison and as he's befriending this character, Zorro. How do you, as the director, while you're making art, how do you be vulnerable? And how does your vulnerability make the TV show better?
That's a very nice question, really. I would say that I wrote all the episodes as well with Ron Lishim. So this process of finding the vulnerability has already started in the writing process, and both Ron, the writer, and my co-creator, I mean, we both eventually are people who seek the next level, or the let's say the deeper level within how we grasp reality. And I think that what we constantly were searching for in the writing, and then for me in the directing, is telling the story through his perspective. Now, it's a kid that has a crazy mother, severe ADHD,
ADHD. I
and
understood what you meant.
and he's a wild kid that doesn't know if he can build his life through being funny, or he needs to be a tough guy, bully, going to prison and doing crimes. And all these contrasts are things that led me through the process, and this is how I also, approached kids and the camera and everything. I mean, always keeping this, complexity of behaviors and complexity of emotions. There's never just one thing that this kid sees in a situation in reality. So, that's, I think, that is what led us through the writing, and then me on set with the boys.
Right, looking for the depth in every aspect, and every part as you move along the project.
And because many times when you direct actors, if I teach you how to direct actors, I'd say, listen, a person can act 1 centimeter at a time, okay? I need you to be angry at me now. I need you to love me now. I need you to break the wall or kick somebody in the face, okay? And usually you would say that to an actor. You would pick one emotion in a situation, but when you work with kids, it's a whole different ball game, because it's not about psychology and it's not about anything at all that you can express with words. It's just about creating a situation to them that they can act in the situation. So it's not about seeking depth in a verbal way, but it's just about creating a situation that their childly existence will just act in.
So, do you mean that when you're directing adults, you can explain adult to adult what this experience is, that the character, what's happening to this character, but with the child, you just sort of have to create the truth of that scene because that's all they can understand is just the truth of it rather than a verbal articulation of what is happening or what they should be feeling? Is that sort
Exactly.
of,
It's exactly that. Because if you tell
Imagine you have a 5-year-old kid and you tell him, now you need to be sad. What would he do?
Frown.
Right? He'd do this and he'd start to weep, and that's not what you want. Instead, you need to create a situation that makes him sad. So it's like directing in very different levels. It's very, very different than directing adults, in which you can express and say, listen, we need to portray a character that also that wants to be a badass man, but also wants to be a funny kid that wants his mommy. You can explain that to an adult, but if you'd say that to a kid, he would just look at you and go somewhere else because he's bored and doesn't understand anything. So
Did you always go in when you're directing children? Do you always go in with that in mind? Because you worked with children in your other film, The Slut, right?
right, there were
With there
two
were two,
girls
two girls who
there.
played your daughters. So is that something that you had to discover as a director of, oh, there is a different way of directing child actors compared to adults? Or did you just always sort of have this understanding that it was going to be different from the get-go?
I never had that understanding until I experienced it. Because, let's say, in The Slut, they were much, much younger. And The Slut was a very, intellectual movie. So it was not about expressing, not, it's, it wasn't about expecting them to express emotions or anything. It's kind of a detached art house movie. So I wasn't seeking, their emotional outbursts or anything like that. Here it was much more insane. But I did, as you saw, I did a short film between, I mean, I don't know, like 3 years ago or something like that. I did a short film with two small girls, and it was, I'll say it briefly, it was a short movie about Ethiopian girl that has straight hair, and she was considered like a phenomena because they all have curly hair, and her bigger sister wanted to cut her hair. Now, I gave the small girl a wig of straight hair, and then the older girl cut the hair in a scene of the wig. But the small girl got so attached to this wig and she felt so special because she suddenly had straight hair that she went crazy. And she cried and she just lost it. And that was when I realized that for kids, you just need to create the situation. That was the moment that I learned how to direct kids because she lost it. And I had, as a filmmaker, the perfect scene, the best scene. I could have never directed that. I could have never make that happen.
That is life imitating art instead of
Exactly.
art imitating life
Exactly.
to a T, because
Exactly.
that was written in the
Yes.
that's so crazy.
Yeah.
Was there a scene like that that you can remember directing in Bad Boy where there was sort of that magic created when you created the situation for those actors?
Yeah, it's what happened in Bad Boy is just the most exciting example of what happens when life and art collide, because everything that's written on script happened behind the scenes.
Meaning what?
Meaning, you put a bunch of 15-year-old boys in a room, and the exact dynamic that their characters have is what happened on set. Guy and Avtamo, Dean and Zorro, became very, very close in the sense of if Avtamo would be late for set or come late, Guy would go just crazy. And the dynamics within the other boys was the exact same thing. Whoever had to be enemy on script became an enemy on set. It was the weirdest thing that could
Why do you
happen.
think that happens?
The chicken and the egg. It's either we cast it right somehow, in a cosmic way, or they had a sense of obligation, or they just, they're all non-actors. None of them acted before. So maybe, they read the roles and somehow everything got mixed up in their conscience between life and reality, because I put them together for day after day in a prison, basically. So, something happened there which was above, what was under my control. It just happened.
That's so interesting, and I wonder if it, you say they're not actors.
No.
I wonder if it has to do with when you're an actor, you're trained to separate the character from yourself or
True.
pull your past traumas into view and then pull them away. But when you have no training, but you're sort of just a raw human at 15, you maybe what happened is they just wanted to know their characters, that they leaned into the reality of what was happening between all of the characters together, because there's no training for separating the art from the life.
Exactly. Avtamo, the guy who's playing Zorro, he was never on a set in his life. He knew nothing about this. And then one day on set, I told him, in episode 7, because they didn't read the entire scripts, I didn't give them to read the entire scripts at all. Like, it was like a whole different process of working. And I told him, in episode 7, we're shooting Zorro's parents. And then he said, "What, you're coming to my parents' house?" So there were moments that really crossed. Something happened there that was very, very special. That's
Wow.
it. That's what I that's the
Yeah.
bottom line
Bottom line, it's
of this very
special and it's
long monologue.
cosmic.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier Dean trying to figure himself out using humor, and also, that's a part of the script, is that this character becomes a comedian. He has enough humor and enough skill in that he
Right.
becomes a comedian. I myself am a comedy writer. A lot of what I do on my show is talk to comedians. For TIFF, I'm talking to everyone, filmmakers, directors, writers.
Amazing.
But normally I talk to comedians. And so I was really interested in this infusion of humor into a really, really dark story,
Right.
and why you decided to add that element in, and why it's important and to a drama to have those moments of levity.
Yeah. So the process of making Bad Boy started before I joined. Ron will tell you, everything that came before I did. And I fell in love with this. I was refusing to do TV for a while, but
You're a
then
filmmaker.
I'm a filmmaker, and then yeah. And then Ron came to me with this material, and the reason that I thought it was so stunning and magnetic and unique is because it was the fact that there's humor in it somehow makes it possible to watch. Because I think it's very manipulative to do Oz with kids. I think the show is
Oz with kids, did
Oz
you call
with
it?
kids. I think it's very manipulative and very tough, and I don't think anybody would want to watch that. But when you tell the story of somebody who became a comedian in prison, it changes the entire as atmosphere of the show, and I think it makes the drama bearable. And to be honest, this is how, I live my life. We have very, very harsh moments, but there's always got to be something funny there, because if there isn't, so I think it's not real. Because for me, humor would always be the answer to everything and the way to cope with everything. Because otherwise, we'd be
It's
just
too hard.
too hard.
I also think Oz with kids, as you put it, or Oz in general, a story where set in such a dark place, that is sort of literally claustrophobic,
Yes.
is so much more compelling when you infuse it in with humor. And not only humor, but now this character
has ambition and is working towards something.
Right.
And that makes it so much more interesting than just boys living out their traumas and fighting each other.
I agree.
Because there's some lightness there.
I agree. Yeah. And it's not even just about the lightness. It's about the motivation of telling a story that has an upside to it. Mm-hmm. And a story that for me, really, that's the basis of truth. The fact that it's both hard and funny at the same time. And this is really, you know, how I want to live my life and usually live my life.
Mm-hmm. And for Bad Boy as a TV show, you said you mostly do film. Television, as I said, I want to be a television writer. I love television. It has an effect that's a little different from film, in a way that you can follow a character over a longer period of time, which for an audience member allows you to grow with that character in your own life and to feel friends with that character and to have that your own connection,
right?
A parasocial relationship are really strong in television because of the longevity of that relationship over time. And I think that this show will have a huge impact for lots of teenage boys in those harsher environments, or any teenage boy who's in an environment with lots of boys and the dynamics of being a teenage boy with other teenage boys and how working that out. And I'm wondering if you had any shows when you were growing up that you felt had a huge impact on you in terms of made you feel seen, or you felt like you could grow with the character you were watching. Were there any shows on growing up that you really connected to?
The Bold and the Beautiful.
No,
I'm joking. But that's actually what my dad would watch. My dad watched The Bold and the Beautiful.
The soap opera?
The soap opera. You know, TV wasn't a big part of my life growing up. It's much more now.
Yeah.
I really liked Alf. Maybe that somehow impacted my hairdo or anything like that, or my nose. I don't know. I loved Alf.
What did you like about it?
I always dreamt of having a small monkey. That was my childhood dream, to have a monkey. And I think, you know, Alf was kind of that, living out the dream that here there's like this creature at somebody's home. I don't remember much, but I remember loving that as a child.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Hagar.
Thank
it's
you.
Been really enlightening and really exciting.
Thanks.
Talking to you. And
thank you.
Congratulations on Bad Boy.
Thank you.
I'm really excited for people to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, welcome, Rond Lachem.
All right. Hello, we're back in the present day, in the present moment. You're here with me, Ruby Raven, on CITR Radio, listening to Shmodio. Let's take a collective breath. Ready? One, two, three. Yeah, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. So that was my interview with Hagar. Isn't she so smart and interesting and thoughtful? She just had like the most calming energy. She had sort of the most graceful, gentle presence. And because of sort of the leftovers of COVID, I haven't really gotten to do a lot of in-person interviews. Most of the interviews that I do are over Zoom. So it really felt different to be in the same room as someone while you're speaking to them and while they're talking about the thing that they're most passionate about. So I was just really, really excited about this interview. Next up, we're going to hear from Rond Lachem. He was referenced in the previous interview with Hagar. He's the executive producer of Bad Boy, and we talk about what he thinks of the show, and it was also equally interesting. Can you believe it? So without further ado, here is my interview at TIFF with Bad Boy creator Rond Lachem. Here we go. Hello?
Okay, welcome, Rond Lachem. You're listening to CITR. My name's Ruby Raven. Thank you so much for coming on our show and for talking to us about your new show, Bad Boy, which premiered at TIFF and people can watch very soon. Bad Boy is about a young teenager named Dean who gets taken away to a juvenile detention center.
and forges a friendship with one of the most violent boys in the detention center, and sort of the politics of being in prison as a teenager, as he finds humor and eventually becomes a successful comedian in his adulthood. So you're a television writer, like a longtime television writer. And I'm wondering why this story was right for television rather than film. What does the medium of television offer this story that film can't?
So first of all, I just love television because as a writer, it gives you the ability. I have this kind of schizophrenia where I love sometimes just being alone in bed writing for weeks, and sometimes being creating with people as a collaboration of 300 people working on set, but also other writers, etc., and living the story for a while. So I chose television where it's where it was more comfortable for me. I love television. I've always loved television. So I never thought of this as a film, but in a strange way, it's because I started as a journalist, and when I was like a 20-year-old journalist, I locked myself in this prison. It's not even a detention center. It's like it's a dark prison, but with kids, tiny 12-year-olds together with like gorillas who are 18, and I locked myself there for research for about how babies that were born to female prisoners born in jail and were held in prison with the mothers, and sometimes were torn from the mothers when they are 2 year old, because that's the law. You can raise a baby in jail, and then when they're two, they take it away from you because they need the outside or whatever. And all of those babies in the history of our country were back in jail before the age of 15 themselves. And I wanted to do an investigative report about that, but I locked myself in prison, and I kind of, nothing prepares you to the moment you step into this thing. And they're singing Disney songs, and they're cuddling, and they're boys, and they're kids. And then a moment later, they're like completely violent, and it all explodes. And you feel really sorry for them, because there's something that you immediately feel that they didn't give it. It's not like adult prisoners. These kids were never given a chance to be anything else. But for a while, I was really trying hard to find a way to tell this story. And either and even when I pitched Euphoria for the first time, I pitched this show, and
really?
And the networks back then said, oh, you can't do a show about kids in prison, it's like the audience is not ready for that. That was the answer. So Euphoria, even when we started writing Euphoria, the lead character was the son of the prisoners, and then it developed, and we had to put it aside, this idea. And Euphoria filled my next years, because first we did Euphoria in Israel, and then for 7 years I was going around LA trying to convince networks to do Euphoria, and everyone said no to it. And then when Euphoria was already a success, the network asked me what do you want to do next, and I said, oh, now it's the time. If you allow me to do whatever I want, that's the thing we need to do. We always wanted this to be this, like. And in LA, when I'm part of Euphoria, in LA, people treat me as, oh, you're the dude from the Middle East, bring us espionage and terror and war stories. And yeah, I wrote a few thrillers and an espionage story, but I was really fighting hard to get out of this typecast, because this is what I want to do, these stories. And this is, so for me, it's really a passion project. Sometimes I'm a writer, sometimes I'm a producer. I've done 5 shows this year, but this is my passion project, like writing this.
So I didn't know that you had originally pitched Euphoria as Bad Boy. And I remember I was the same age as the characters in Euphoria when Euphoria came out, maybe a year or two older. And I remember how seen it made a lot of my friends feel, specifically some of my male queer friends, that the darkness and the underbelly of teenagehood was really being exposed. And I also remember how shocking it was to the culture, like just the amount of discourse that there was about the darkness of the show and showing that amount of darkness for teenagers. Do you think that Euphoria was like, had to be the precursor before Bad Boy? Like, did it prepare the world? Did it prepare audiences for a new genre of shows that and prepare audiences to be able to watch shows about children in those tough, really dark positions?
I never thought of this way, and maybe you're probably right, but the Bad Boy also, the moment we felt that we can do the show is the moment that we found one element factor that was missing in all our pitches in the past, and that's the humor, which is another, because when we pitched Bad Boy, and people were saying, oh, you can't do kids in jail, but then when we realized that when I was a journalist, one of the kids who was there was a stand-up comedian who is now very successful, but no one knows that he just changed his name, and no one knows that he was a boy in prison. And when suddenly our producer, Tamia, she said, you know, this stand-up comedian was there in jail with you when you came as a journalist. And so I was shocked. And then we said, oh, the humor, the fact that the prison made him a stand-up comedian, and the fact that the drama teacher in prison made him a stand-up comedian, and also the humor maybe got him into trouble, but his ADHD and his imagination, everything that made the show possible. But with Euphoria, you know, I think the one thing we had with Euphoria from the very first moment, because Euphoria had changed so many times along the way, but the one thing we had with Euphoria from the very first moment is the idea that it is emotional realism and not realism, much like Bad Boy. You never know if that's how he remembers things, but when you create Euphoria, the Euphoria thing is all about trying to create the world as it feels and looks in the eyes of the characters and what they wish and what they hope, the characters that exist in this world, right? And it's not realism. And I love it how when people are saying, wow, it feels so real, but at the same time, it feels, oh, no one acts this way, no one wears this makeup. Or, yeah, Euphoria does have the payoffs that are sometimes more, not in a bad way, but more soapy, in as a payoffs, because you have female characters and romance and the prison with kids doesn't necessarily allow this. But the one thing you always want to do as a writer, especially because LA is a place where you are typecast as something, and then they want you your entire career to do the same. But you, every time, you want to explore new themes. And for me, it was about, for example, here, exploring a mother and son, much as like, in Euphoria, it was exploring the queerness that I wanted to do and how it will feel to live in a world where you just fall in love with a person who makes you feel comfortable and cared for regardless of gender, for example. Every time you feel like there's something else you want to tell the world, right? So a new thing.
I think that's really interesting talking about the emotional realism, because in the American Euphoria, Rue is this classic unreliable narrator. And that's really exciting to see from a protagonist, especially from a female protagonist. But when you talk about the humor in this series, how that was the turning point for selling it. I was talking to Hagar about the humor of it too, because when I first read the synopsis, that really got me, that this character was in this incredibly dark place, literally and mentally, and what came out of it was so much humor. So I am a comedy writer. I love television. I want to be a television writer. And this show is normally a comedy show. For TIFF, we're normally interview comedians and comedy writers, but for TIFF, we're interviewing everyone for the show. So I was really excited to see that there was this element of comedy. And I asked her, and I'll ask you, why is it so important to have that element of comedy in a drama that in Euphoria too, there's those light moments. Why is it so important to have comedy infused in these dark, dramatic pieces? And why does it make stories so much more compelling?
I think in the interesting thing is that it's a show. So Euphoria for me, it's about a lot of things. And you would argue, and we will argue, everyone watches it in a different way. Like,
that's the best part.
I think Rue is non-binary, and a lot of us as creators thought that Rue is non-binary, and everyone. But when I meet audiences, they feel differently sometimes. But the one thing that was very clear about Euphoria, for me, at the very first moment and all through the journey, and Sam was this brilliant, brilliant creator and soul that is creating the American version. It's a show about empathy, and the one thing that. Strangely, the one thing that helps create the empathy more than anything else is not manipulations of like tears, and is humor. The humor in Euphoria and the humor in this show that is kind of a comedy in many aspects about the juvenile jail, but the humor is the tool to get the empathy and to get to help you be in the skin of someone else and under watch the world through the eyes and point of view of someone else. And but because so it's not just about, oh, we need this to be light, so we need a bit of moments of compassion and moments of relief, so we need the humor to relieve, because it's not just that. A lot of executives will say, oh, it's dark and it's sad, let's have some humor just for relief. For me, it's much more. It's about the empathy.
Right. The humor isn't there to offset anything. It's there truthfully. It's there to in a very real way for these characters, because he's using his comedy as an escape from this terrible place. I was also really fascinated when I first read, I'm just remembering back to when I first read the synopsis, what were the things that I was hanging on that really stuck in my mind? And the other one was that Dean, the protagonist, he forges a best friendship with Zorro, who is the most violent, psychotic, it says, inmate. And that really interests me too. What do you think audiences love about befriending the murderer, befriending the most dangerous person in the prison? Because I sort of, it's almost like a fantasy. It's almost like a safety. Why do you think, and I think that the same can be said for some of those relationships in Euphoria that are toxic, that are unsafe, but there's also something, some fantasy element to it. What do you think that is between the protagonist and a more dangerous character?
So I think that Dean is a boy who was already, when he was 12 years old, he was already a comedian in a sense that he looked at the world and about as people, as characters, and he was attracted to characters that are intriguing and different and has these unique voices and are a mystery, but also has this the funniest nuances that you can notice. But and I think our story tells the moment where he is sent to the cell with a boy who everyone considers a psychopath and is a killer, and everyone wants to kill this boy, and he's under protective protection, and everyone wants Dean to kill this boy because Dean is the only one who has access to this boy, but Dean kind of fall in love with this boy, and that idea comes first, and I think first because he's really like intrigued by the question of, it's mysterious, like, is this beautiful boy who's just smiling and fun and cute, can he be a murderer? I'm like, I don't believe this. But the next thing is that as a comedian, Zorro becomes his first audience, because Zorro laughs at a joke that no one else until then was laughing at a joke. So, oh, this is my, I love performing to this boy, so I'm falling in love with him, right? And I find myself, my spot as a comedian. Although Dean is a boy who always didn't want people to say, oh, you're a clown, you're funny, you're cute. He wanted to say, he was looking for people to think he is frightening. This is why he was dreaming of becoming this, I don't know, like Stringer Bell type of criminal, right? So it's kind of complicated, right?
So you're saying that Dean didn't want people to think of him as a clown. He wanted them to fear him. So why does he enjoy when Zorro really laughs at his jokes and finds him funny if he wants to be feared?
He still all through the season, I think he still wants to be strong enough to be feared, like to it changed kind of his the way he talks and the way he acts in order for people to survive in jail. But there is something so beautiful about Zorro's laugh and the fact that it is almost impossible to crack Zorro, in a sense that Zorro knows that he's there for 25 years, and every boy that will stand like Dean will come for 2 months, 4 months. He knows that if he will get attached to him, he will lose him forever anyway. So Zorro makes all the efforts in the world not to get attached. So it makes Dean wants badly to get his attention and get him attached.
Such a comedian.
Yeah. And then I think that he's like, when Zorro does everything possible not to get attached, and Dean for the first time finds, well, I'm finding a way to make him fall in love with me back. Like that's the achievement makes it attractive for him.
I also wonder if, like, when you're describing Dean's interest in Zorro, everyone else fears him, everyone else wants him dead,
and Dean kind of falls in love with him, romantic or otherwise. I wonder if, like, as a stand-up comedian, when you think about Dean as a stand-up, stand-ups are observers. They observe the human condition. They observe the society around them. And maybe one of the most violent people that he's been exposed to reveals something about the human condition, like the extremes of the human condition. And that's why that excites Dean so much. And that's why he wants to be around him, because as an observer of people, he really sees humanity in Zorro.
And I'll make one spoiler and I'll say, there is a moment where in real life, in the real story, but also in the series, where Dean is released and he is home, and he misses not just Zorro, he misses the prison a lot. So he finds his way back. And the thing is that in the real story as well, as an observer, people on the outside were so boring. They were not just looking down at him as, oh, you were the kid that were in, like, humiliating, and you're the kid that was in jail. But also they were boring, and the characters in jail are like a comedy act. Each character in jail is the funniest, craziest psychopath
weirdo.
and this is something he is an observer is really attracted to. Absolutely. So he starts performing in jail, and also in our show, and this is something like you would see in the future episodes, he is a comedian now, when as a mature comedian, when he's 35-year-old, he never tells the truth on stage. He never said, I was in jail. He never said stories about each other in jail, although it's gold, right? And during his journey as a mature comedian in the series, he decides to start performing with the materials about jail. And for the first time, he sits on stage and is saying, I'm going to tell you something I've never told anyone. So it was about how comedy is born for us.
And that always makes the best comedy, is the place that the comedy that comes from those really truthful, raw places that people are afraid to talk about. I haven't had a chance to see the show yet, to see the screening, because I wasn't able to get to the press and industry. But even listening to you describe these characters and describe the show, my heart was falling, my chest was falling. I was following along the storyline. And, you know, that's in part because it's a fantastic storyline, and in part because I already started to imagine watching these characters' journey. And with television, like I said, I love television. I grew up just obsessed with television. With television, you can follow these characters' journeys as you grow as a human over a long period of time, and have these really intense parasocial relationships. And they can comfort you when you're sad or at the end of a hard day. And as someone who has a lot of these shows myself that shaped me, you're a television writer who loves television and who loves writing. What are some of those shows that shaped you when you were growing up, that made you want to be a writer, that made you interested in story, and that made you interested in people?
So I would say, before mentioning the shows, I would say there's something beautiful about your generation, that when the journey of binging for your generation is typically, it's a journey that helps you identify yourself and makes these decisions about what you identify with, and it helps you be create empathy and be a citizen of the world, and try to make sure to explore what I identify with it, and so on. For me, I think there are a lot of shows I love, but there's one show that made me, when I was a journalist, but one show that made me decide I want to do this and there is a reason for that. And that show is the HBO adaptation for Angels in America. And the thing is that Angels in America, that when Tony Kushner wrote it as a play, it was the 80s, and in New York, people were dying outside on a daily basis. Like, if you were queer, your entire community was dying around you every day. And you were stepping into buildings and you see people taking out their books and putting it in the staircases just to let people take it, because they're leaving back home to die with their parents and knowing they're going to die. And then you were stepping into the theater with this red ribbon and sitting there watching a theater play that feels as if it was written 20 years later, with the bird eye perspective that understands the politics and the problems and how we will look at this time 20 years from now. And it was just brilliant because it was the most, on the one hand, the most realistic, but because of the hallucinations that the medications did, they could do a lot of fantasy and of course it was Meryl Streep and Emma Thompson and everyone, but it made me like, and there's one thing you would always as a writer die to write, but you most likely won't have a chance or a chance of a once in a lifetime. And that is this, the moment that you can identify something that is happening right now, help people digest it and explore it and think of it, and be able to look at it in a bird's eye view. And all we do as writers is try to believe that art can transform the world with the truth, and we work out our grief and our deep desires to make people happy and everything, and our rage, a lot of rage, because what's going on all over us, and that's what made me say, well, I want to be a theater writer.
That experience that you had, and what you just said in being able to capture the moment we're in while we're in it, is that something, an understanding of that play that you had immediately as you saw it, and then going forward from there, a goal that you had as a writer is to capture the moment while we're in it? Or is it something that you ruminated on for many years, only to realizing years later that that is what you took away from it?
I think so. I think the moment I watched it, I said, well, if I could do something like this once in my, like in my entire life, I would be the happiest person. But also, it's, there with Euphoria was born because I was a nerdy kid, and when I watched Trainspotting or Gus Van Sant or Larry Clark, Elephant Kids, I kind of said, well, no one would ever allow me to do this, because as a writer, they expect you to write just about yourself. And for me, writing, because the writing is about empathy and being someone else and understanding the point of view of someone else, writing for me is about writing my alter ego and writing someone else and writing. So when I watched Trainspotting and Requiem for a Dream and Larry Clark and Gus Van Sant, I said, oh, wow, this is a dream. If I could write this, no one would allow me to write this. But I was obsessed with proving that I can do this because this is my alter ego and I can live in that world. So that this is another moment when I said, okay, I want to be a writer because I want to be someone I'm not and something I've missed, because I wasn't that 17-year-old, right?
I also have to say, when you're writing with empathy in mind, when you're writing as an empathetic person for the goal of understanding people, that empathy comes through to audiences and allows them to have empathy for people that they have never met before. So I just want to thank you for writing from that place, because it creates a new understanding for people that might be scared of a different type of person. So thank you so much. And thank you for your time and for your insight today. It was lovely. And congratulations on Bad Boy.
Thanks so much.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. We are back in the present moment. You're listening to Shmodio. My name is Ruby. We're almost out of time today. Weren't those interviews just so freaking fantastic? I said at the beginning of the episode that I was going to talk a bit about a film that I saw at TIFF called In the Rear View. I'm not great at time management, okay? I'm just not. So what I'm going to do is read the synopsis of the film that's on the TIFF website, just because I do want to share what this movie is, what this film is. It's not a movie, it's a film. And then when I have Callum on, he also saw the film with me, we can sort of talk about our thoughts on the film. But for right now, I'll just read what the film was about. So it's called In the Rear View, and the documentarian is named Makiek Hamila. Makia Camila's minimalist debut documentary is an expansive road trip through the invasion that drove more than 15 million refugees, more than one-third of Ukraine's population, in search of safer pastures. Born in the 1980s, director Makia Camila was part of the first generation of Poles not forced to study Russian. Still, he took it upon himself to learn the oppressor's language. In 2013, when the Ukrainian president, pressured by Russia, refused to sign an association agreement with the EU, the masses protested at Kiev's Maidan Square. Hamila traveled to join them. There, he made lifelong friends and forged a devotion to Ukraine. Years later, in the initial days of Russia's full-scale invasion, he purchased a van and began evacuating civilians, mostly women and children, now all refugees, to Poland. Within a week, he purchased two more vans and hired a driver who doubles as a camera person to capture prosaic conversations about what was and what may be. In the rear view, which screened Cannes' ACID program and won top prizes at Warsaw's Dock Against Gravity and Sheffield Dockfest, is a raw, minimalist observation of unfolding war. Outside the van, destroyed by military equipment and leveled houses, line the roads. Rockets sound above. Inside the claustrophobic vehicle, occasionally a makeshift ambulance, Hamila is seemingly always headed west, looking back at his passengers, stopping at checkpoints, avoiding minefields, resting in bunkers, and traversing hundreds of thousands of kilometers. Hamila's tenacity as a driver and director turns the van into a portal between the past and the future. For audiences who have not known occupation, fatigue at news of the war may be understandable. For Ukrainians, there is no other option but to focus on the road ahead. So that is In the Rear View. That is the film, one of the films that I saw at TIFF that I was really moved by. And I just want to tell everyone about it, because sometimes when I go to the theater to watch the new film that everyone's talking about, I leave the theater and I don't always feel moved by what I've seen. So at TIFF, I was so excited to be moved by every single one of the films that I saw. So if you get a chance, so far In the Rear View doesn't have a Canadian distributor, but I'll keep listeners posted, because I feel this way about every film that I saw at TIFF, but I just want everyone I know to watch this film. And I'll continue to share the films that I saw at TIFF, and hopefully we'll be able to uncover some of the distributors that were some of the distributing deals that were made at TIFF, because that is, after all, one of the points of TIFF. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Shout out to my best friend, Lily, and have a wonderful day. I hope if you're driving to get lunch right now, you're going to eat something so delicious, so nourishing. Like, I don't know, like a vindaloo, or like I recently had like a really good spring roll, so that could be good too. Something with like rice and chicken or tofu if you're vegan. I just hope you're gonna feel really good after eating lunch today. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back next Friday with more TIFF coverage. Bye.